at first I was like, okay, like maybe the reason why I feel so unfulfilled is because my job isn't meaningful enough. I thought like maybe this is the route I need to go. I need to become a war correspondent. And, you know, I'm like the biggest wimp in the world. So my parents and my wife thought this was like such a ridiculous idea. And so I rethought that plan. And after a few months, I actually realized like, you know, that was exactly the opposite of what I needed to do. It wasn't that I needed to find a job that was even more engrossing than the job I already had. I actually needed to find a job or do my job in a way that didn't require 120% of my energy all the time, 24/7. And maybe by doing that, I'd be able to find more time in my life to do other things that could fulfill me too outside of my career.
Hi, I'm Emily McDowell.
And I'm Holly Whitaker.
And this is Quitted,
a podcast about quitting. Hi.
Hi.
It's like finally spring-ish, kind of.
It is like absolutely pelting down rain here, and I love it. I'm so into it.
I know. I actually really appreciate the rain. I do not appreciate the snow, and the snow is melting, and I bought flowers, and I'm committed to spring now. So, and it's just amazing how quickly I have such seasonal stuff, and it's so amazing how quickly I come back to life when spring comes.
Yeah.
Maybe
we come back to life. I mean, yes,
we do.
Like,
well, I mean,
like
I just wonder, but I just wonder if I should be living in a constant spring. I mean, you know,
the answer is yes. Yeah, I mean, I think people who get really affected seasonally, I think it's so hard to live through winter, and to just, you know, accept that for 6 months of the year you're going to feel bad because of how it is outside. Like, it's so hard.
Really,
I remember
hard.
When I first moved to the West Coast, I was like, I grew up in Massachusetts, and then I lived in Minnesota for 8 years. And I was like, wait a minute, we can just not do that. Like, I'm deeply affected by winter. I can do rain, but snow can just bite me. Like, I can't, when I can't go outside, when it hurts to go outside, which it does in Minnesota for most of like the winter, I just, there's something, my whole body just constricts and I hate it and I'm miserable and I hate it. And when I first came to the West Coast, I was like, wait a minute, like, you don't have to do winter. Like, I can opt out of this.
Well, I think it's like you don't realize too the impact or the toll that it takes on you. And there are some bodies that just do really well in the winter. And I know people that have seasonal affective disorder related to warmer weather. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's just like my skin, you know, gets, I mean, I won't list it all, but it's just not fun. So Emily and I did a poll recently on our Patreon and community, in our Patreon community. And we're experimenting still, and we're trying to figure out what kind of intro we want to do. And so far the survey says a short intro with some personal detail about us. That's what's leading. And
that's
then
in
second place is a longer intro with some personal information. And I think that we're probably going to settle on shorter intros and occasionally just bore the shit out of you talking for 20 minutes about Mandy Patinkin.
And you can fast forward through it. It's great.
And you can fast. We're also going to start to do timestamps so you can like get right to the meat of the episode. But I thought that was interesting. I mean, I never know. Like, people listen to podcasts for all kinds of different reasons. And some people really love hearing, you know, long story. I do have a funny story very quickly. One time we had a guy, like one of the first men we interviewed on our podcast, and he,
on home.
And we used the word, but we had a long intro and we promoted, we made no money off that podcast. Laura and I did a long intro. We promoted both of our businesses. And then we talked about our vaginas a little bit. And then this man who is like, you know, like some spiritual leader and like, you know, super hip or whatever, told us that he wasn't going to share the podcast with his hundreds of thousands of followers if we didn't take, if we didn't cut the entire intro. God. And I remember I was like, let's just do it. Let's just bow. And then Laura was actually like, we are not fucking doing that. And we ended up pushing forward with it. And we were just like, fuck your hundreds of thousands of followers. We're talking about our vaginas. Like, anyway.
And fuck you for making us feel ashamed of talking about our vaginas. Like, no, you know,
such a piece of work. Well, I think it was like all attention wasn't on him. You know, and like we were talking about our businesses and we were talking about our hoo-has, and that was just a line he couldn't cross. Anyway, fun times. Okay, so today we have Aki Ito.
We do. Aki Ito is a journalist who writes about work and the history of work and the future of work. And we came across an article she wrote in Business Insider that was pretty fascinating, and I learned so much from it. And so we wanted to have her on.
Yeah. I mean, like, you sent it to me and you were like, read that. You like, you went to the length of, because it's Business Insider and it's behind a paywall, of copy and pasting the entire episode and
it's
sending
like
it to me.
It's like a 10,000 word article. It's like a 27 page document because it is a paywall. I could have just shared my password. Turns out that's actually easier, which I ultimately did. But
yeah, sorry, Business Insider. But anyway, yeah, it's a fascinating read. And Aki, I think like she, I mean, what I love so much about this, and we'll get into this very shortly. I love that she is writing from a place of self-exploration. And the thing that I found most valuable about this was not necessarily all the facts that she had already, you know, produced in her article, and also that she expanded on with us. But I loved how much she talked about her own self-experimentation, knowing what she knows. And that to me, I think, was the richest part of this. So anyway.
Enjoy.
So before we go into this episode, I am going to ask you, plead with you, dear listener, because there's thousands of you and we don't have very many reviews. And so I cannot begin to tell you what a huge benefit it is to the show by you taking the time to go into Apple Podcasts and hit, you know, however many stars you want to give us. 5 are great, or even leave us a review. If you really want to help us out, this is a self-funded podcast. We don't have advertising dollars at this point, and it really helps us as well, your support, your financial support on our Patreon community. So you can go to patreon.com/quitted. We just appreciate you listening to this. So, you know, if you don't want to do that, that's fine too. We still love you. Is that good?
That's great. Aki Ito, welcome to Quitted.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here.
I'm really excited for this. I love
it. Me too.
I went on we both did like a deep dive of your work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
More than the story that you wanted to talk about today. Wow. Thank you so much.
We know everything.
We have your fifth grade privilege. Teacher waiting. No, not in an ominous way. Like, we just got so interested in the threads that you were weaving together in your reporting and what you were reporting on that we just both kind of fell down that rabbit hole a little bit. So
we're
excited to talk with you. So you wrote this really fantastic article for Business Insider called How Hustle Culture Got America Addicted to Work. And it blew my mind because it answered so many of the questions I've had about how and why we got here, meaning this glorification of overwork and long hours as a badge of honor and all of it. So before we get into your research and reporting, tell us a little bit about you and your work. So like, we saw that you worked at Bloomberg, you work at Business Insider, you lived in San Francisco. These are all code words for a person who might work a lot. So
yeah, you got me there.
Yeah. We've cracked the code and deciphered. So what got you interested in taking a look at hustle culture? And is there a personal reason for you behind why you started writing about this?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. This story started on a very personal note for me. Because during the pandemic, I had this really big realization that I was just spending way too much of my life thinking about work, doing work, planning for work, relying on work for, you know, fulfillment and happiness. And I really resolved to live my life a little differently going forward. At first, I thought I was unique in this realization. I thought it was just me. I thought it was, you know, I was uniquely needy for recognition and accolades and all that stuff. But of course, over the course of many months and more than a year, it became really clear to me that I was not the only person going through this. Transformation sounds like so big, but through this, you know, pretty big realization that I wanted to live my life differently and that it involved making work less central in my life. So I thought, like, if we as an entire society have come to this point where work was the primary source of meaning and fulfillment in our lives, how did we get here in the first place? Because I had a vague idea that it's not like this in Europe. I knew it wasn't like this in Japan, where I'm from. And I also had a vague idea that it wasn't like this, you know, in the beginning in this country. And so that got me digging into the long history of American work culture and the battle between work and leisure over the course of about 150 years in American history, starting in the Industrial Revolution. And I wanted to understand how we got here because I thought that context was important to start to talk about how American work culture could be different going forward. So yes, that's a very long answer to your very simple question, but it started on a very personal note for me.
Like, you mean you were in the pandemic and you were like being in lockdown. Is that what you're saying kind of was what brought that realization?
Yeah. I mean, it was the lockdown, but I think my story is probably a little unique in the sense that I wasn't working when the pandemic hit. Throughout 2019, my wife and I had concocted this plan to travel the world. She had just finished law school and passed the California bar exam. And we figured this was like the only time we could do something like this, like take substantial amount of time away from the workforce before things got too busy once we started a family.
Yeah.
And so I left my job of 10 years at Bloomberg in January 2020 to travel the world for about 8 months.
I was like really hoping this wasn't where this was going. I was like, did you
get
coming
in? Back from a world tour in March 2020?
Yeah. So it was a horrifically timed trip. We got to do about a month and a half of it in Southeast Asia before we really had to cut it short. And we went to Japan, where I'm from and where my parents still are. So we were in Japan with my family for about 6 months. And, you know, I wasn't working. I couldn't see my friends. I got to see my family, but that was about it. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. And, you know, I also think that, like, one of the reasons why I, you know, decided to take this time away from work was because I had kind of sensed that something was a little off in my life. I felt like a little empty and I didn't quite understand why, because I love my job. And I thought that's, you know, kind of all you needed to live a happy life. And so, you know, early on in the pandemic, actually, I read, you know, a few really wonderful memoirs by these war correspondents. And at first I was like, okay, like maybe the reason why I feel so unfulfilled is because my job isn't meaningful enough. Like, you know, compared to these war correspondents who are putting their lives on the line to report these incredible stories about, you know, global atrocities, my work as a financial journalist, at the end of the day, it's about money.
Right.
And, you know, it can have an impact on people's lives, but it's not like my stories are leading to like big legislation or anything. And so, yeah, I thought like maybe this is the route I need to go. I need to become a war correspondent. And, you know, I'm like the biggest wimp in the world. So my parents and my wife thought this was like such a ridiculous idea. And so I rethought that plan. And after a few months, I actually realized, like, you know, that was exactly the opposite of what I needed to do. it wasn't that I needed to find a job that was even more engrossing than the job I already had. I actually needed to find a job or do my job in a way that didn't require 120% of my energy all the time, 24/7. And maybe by doing that, I'd be able to find more time in my life to do other things that could fulfill me too outside of my career. And so by the time I started at Business Insider in January 2021, I had a pretty clear idea of how I wanted to live my life differently. Some days, you know, I'm more successful than others. I will admit that writing this very story, I spent more than a few late nights writing, some very long days thinking and stressing out about whether the story was actually going to work. But yeah, I definitely work less than I used to back when I was at Bloomberg. And I think that's been good for me.
It's such an interesting thing, that idea, like when you aren't fulfilled. I know so many people that think that the fix is in finding more meaningful work. Like the first thing that they consider is that if I find a more meaningful job, like Emily's a perfect example, right? Like I'm leaving advertising and I'm going to build a business based on my own creativity, which also just led to the same kind of dissatisfaction. And I think that so many people, when like it doesn't even occur to them, I think a lot of people believe that it's just the default that the work is supposed to bring meaning into your life and that everything else is secondary.
Yes.
Yeah. But as I wrote in my story, you know, like that wasn't always the way it was. We take it for granted today because this is all we know, especially people, you know, around our age range. But it wasn't like this before. This is a pretty unique situation in history. And it's also incredibly unique when you compare it to every other country in the world.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that. So your Business Insider piece, it starts off by talking about how Benjamin Franklin dreamed of a 4-hour work week. And when we think of Benjamin Franklin, we probably think he worked his ass off.
Or how the founding fathers- think of Tim Ferriss and Benjamin Franklin.
Like same guy, basically.
4-hour work week, same guy.
Elon Musk, Benjamin Franklin, Tim Ferriss. Or how the founding fathers believed like the U.S. and not Europe would lead us into leisurely future, like a leisurely future, right? And then I also read this book over the summer called Work, and I had never heard this before, but I've heard it multiple times since about John Maynard Keynes, the economist, who had prophesied, I think in the 30s, that we would become so efficient, our technology would advance to such a certain degree that we would essentially be able to get our work week down to, I think he said, like 15 hours a week. And so that's interesting, right? Because what your article revealed to me and to Emily, I think what like really popped for us was this idea, like it hasn't always been this way. Because when you think of America, you think about like pull up your bootstraps and individualism and capitalism and like American capitalism. And you think of like really, really like this like gritty work ethic. And what's so interesting is that like it wasn't this way not very long ago. So can you talk about what was so different in America, like during the time of those prophecies, that made us value free time and leisure?
You know, when you go all the way back to 1870, which is right in the middle of the Industrial Revolution in America, Americans were working like just over 60 hours a week with maybe 2 weeks off if they were very lucky. So they worked a lot. It was just work, 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 constant work. And they had no time for anything else, basically. And from the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution, workers really fought this. They formed labor unions. And at the time, labor unions became quite powerful. And these unions pushed not only for higher pay, but also for fewer hours. And so, you know, starting from 1870 all the way to about 1980, Americans worked less and less and less. So, you know, in 1870, Americans worked about 3,100 hours a year. That came all the way down to about 1,800 by the 1980s. So it was an almost halving of the work year, which is incredible. But around 1980, that progress stopped. And today, we Americans work just as much as we did in 1980, which is incredible because you have this, you know, century-long decline in work hours that suddenly stops. So in some ways, my story was about like that big mystery. Like, what actually happened here?
Because then also the piece of your story that was fascinating was that in Europe, it didn't stop. In Europe, that decline didn't stop. It kept going.
Right.
So we hit 1980 and we stopped, whereas in Germany, they're now working 10 weeks a year less than Americans do.
Right. And I think our first instinct when we hear statistics like that is to be like, oh, well, they're Europeans. They're really good at vacations. That's what they do. Right. They don't work really hard. But that wasn't actually always the case. Like up until the 1970s, you know, Europeans worked more than Americans. So it's a pretty recent phenomenon that Americans are working more than Europeans. And that really speaks to how unique the stall out and the decline in work hours is in America.
I think that's so interesting too, because what I take for granted is the way things are now and assume, right, that it's always been this way to a degree, mm-hmm. like that our values kind of undergirded this current state of, you know, work being the paramount thing in our lives. And you write in this, and I think it's really fascinating that if you tell, and like that there was an Italian study that was done a few years ago that found if you told an American you worked long hours, they assumed you were rich. But if you told an Italian the same thing, they assumed you were poor.
Right.
And so these things feel really ingrained, right? Like they feel like kind of the way they always were, but they weren't. And is, did you in your article, like, and in your research, track down like what the pivotal moment was that actually, like, why did we stall?
Yeah, yeah. I think there were a lot of reasons. And, you know, this, there's like a whole kind of, you know, a niche in, you know, economics and sociology and American history with scholars actually trying to answer this question of why the progress stalled here in America. You know, a big part of the answer, I think, is the decline in American labor unions. Unions were such a big force in pushing for fewer hours. But, you know, since World War II, they've become a lot less powerful. And as a result, there isn't this like big force pushing for fewer hours the way that we used to have. Another big thing, I think, is growing income inequality because, you know, rich people were getting paid so much more than before. It increasingly became more worthwhile to work really hard. If everyone's getting paid about the same, it's not really worth it, right? But if you're getting paid like, you know, twice as much, three times as much, four times as much as other people, then it becomes more worthwhile to really work yourself to the bone. So I think that was a big factor too. Mm. But I think like, you know, all of these different factors combined created a very unique culture in America that valued work above everything else. And I think those cultural attitudes that Americans have towards work kind of took a life on their own, especially after the 1980s, to the point where, you know, by the 2010s, especially in Silicon Valley, you know, work was everything. Work was how you changed the world. And if you were doing anything less, then you were kind of a loser. Mm.
Yeah, and that work was the thing that was supposed to give your life meaning.
Yeah.
And that work was the reason for being. I mean, just the whole – the shift towards this badge of honor of working long hours and working for something that you came to believe was meaningful, whether or not it actually was meaningful, like,
yeah.
was so – I mean, I graduated college in 1998. And moved to San Francisco, and I worked in advertising for the first 10 years of my career. And we were just indoctrinated into this culture of, if you don't show up on Sunday, you don't have a job on Monday. Like, it was that kind of a thing. And we liked it. Or I made myself like it.
Yeah.
Like, I actively brainwashed myself into, like, there was a switch that flipped, right, where I had to believe that what I was doing was important. Because if I didn't, I would be like, why am I working on Christmas on like a banner ad for an insurance company?
You know? Right,
like,
right.
Like, there was sort of a brainwashing that we did to ourselves where we genuinely, honestly believed that what we were doing was important and that it gave us importance. So like, you know, I was so happy to get a BlackBerry because I was like, I didn't think, like, my first work BlackBerry, I was like, I'm so important. Like, it feels so good to be so important to my boss that they're going to want to get a hold of me at 8 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had the same, I mean, I started work at Deloitte & Touche. I was a staff accountant in Silicon Valley in early 2000. And the same thing, which was I actually made more work for myself because I believed that if I was necessary in that capacity and good at my job, if I was getting emails on the weekends that I had to respond to, like, I broke into a client's one time to, like, get a file because how I got this level of, like, not even just, like, import, but just this like, level of, like, making my life worth something. And I think it's – and also I hated it, you know? It was also soul-sucking. But I think in your article, right, you linked to Steve Jobs' speech – and what did he say? What was the quote that he said at his Stanford speech?
He said something along the lines of, you know, your work is going to be the thing that gives you the most fulfillment. So make right. sure you do what you love.
Right.
Yeah, probably like one of the most famous commencement speeches in contemporary America, I think.
And then you have like Elon Musk who's saying, no one ever changed the world in 40-hour work weeks. And right. so it's this like fascinating thing that you don't really see when you're in it, how this thing becomes the top priority of your life because we're told this is the only way and the most important way that you get meaning out of your life. It's the reason that you exist.
Yeah, exactly.
And also these people, the Elon Musks and the Steve Jobs of the world, they're the people who benefit the most from hustle culture.
Right.
Because they're the wealthiest people at the very top. So if we show up at work pre-indoctrinated to tying our own worth to our productivity and to wanting to change the world by working at their company 80 hours a week, like that's their dream because it makes their jobs that much easier.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a fiction that serves them, serves right. the owners of these companies more than the actual workers putting in the work.
And it makes it easier, you know, it's like so much easier to motivate and attract employees who already buy into the idea that their value is dependent on their evolution or their devotion to the job. Like,
yeah,
because they don't have to teach anybody. Like, they're like, oh, cool. Like, you guys already show up believing this. Like, all we have to do is kind of parrot it back.
Well, I think one of the interesting findings that I talked about in my story is that, you know, back around the 1890s, so like, you know, probably the peak of the Industrial Revolution in America, it was the poor who worked the most and the rich who worked the least. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Like the whole reason why people had money back then was so they could enjoy their lives of leisure, so they didn't have to work so hard. But there was something, you know, that changed around like 1970s and 1980s, where suddenly it was rich people who were working the most and it was poor people who were working the least. So when you look at this stall out and the decline in work hours in America, it's really driven by the behavior of, you know, the upper middle class in the country. It's not because, you know, poor people are working more, for example. And I thought that was so interesting because that statistic, that finding tells you more than anything else how work became an end in its own right in this country. Before, it was a means to an end. And the end was, you know, the good life. It was like a leisurely life where you could enjoy time with your family and you didn't have to worry about, you know, earning a living so much. But today it's, you know, an end in its own right. And I found that really powerful.
And I think what's so fascinating about it is how much in my own case, and in so many, let's just take my case specifically. I worked at a startup that eventually IPO'd. I was in it. And the more that my work called my attention to it, in some ways, the more relieved I was. It wasn't just the status symbol, or also like the one way I knew how to perform and be really good. And so it was the thing I was good at, and it made, you know, the things I was shitty at easier. But also I was relieved if I had to work, because then I didn't have to look at my life, right? I didn't actually have to cultivate community. I didn't have to cultivate meaning. I didn't have to really like deal with what was a very, you know, isolated and like sad existence. And so I wonder in your research if like, I mean, that idea of people working to work, in your research, did you uncover anything that is like, it's also because of what we're given, like of what the alternatives are, like how much we don't value as a society? Like, you know, in Italy this summer, every night we had 3-hour dinners. And I was just like, is this what we really do? You know, like, especially as a person who doesn't drink, it's a long thing. But they like, that's a priority and it's just a standard. And here, what I found was, because that standard isn't set, because it's very hard to make community, because no one has a 3-hour meal, because, you know, we don't all go to church on Sunday or have, you know, these different pillars in our culture that give, like, that don't make it so, like, make building a life, I guess is what I'm saying, outside of work. I knew how to do it within work. I didn't know how to build a life outside of work. And I still kind of don't, you know, I still don't know how to do that. And I wonder if in your research, you had any epiphanies about that. I think that you also wrote in one of your articles about Thoreau saying the 7 priorities and how work should be the last. And I wonder if you have come across anything of how we start to shift culture so that for people like me who just do it for these really like honestly good reasons, right? It's just, it makes sense. It's easier then. How do we start to create a culture that allows people or encourages people to build lives outside of just, you know, work and value themselves outside of their title or their whatever.
Their productivity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, when you look back to maybe the early parts of the 1900s, just as Americans were getting more free time, more time away from work, there were all these like community-based institutions that businesses and governments were building out at the time to serve Americans who are getting more leisure time. So, for example, this was around the time when, like, you know, saloons were built. So people would gather in saloons. A lot of that became kind of like political organizing. They also built like dance halls, I think, and amusement parks, public parks. Those were all built around the early 1900s when Americans were getting more and more free time. And at the same time, the you know, all these local governments and nonprofits were also building things like, you know, libraries and all these other kind of more wholesome institutions to allow people to get together and spend their free time. But I think, you know, the interesting thing is that especially kind of in the latter half of the 1900s, TV became such an important part of American leisure. And today, when you think about how you spend your free time, I'm sure Netflix is like a pretty big part of it. I mean, I'm a little bit embarrassed to say it too, but it certainly is for me.
I feel attacked.
Yeah. And when you think about watching TV, it's a very like isolating act. It's passive, first of all. So you're just kind of sitting back and you usually don't do it with anyone else. You might do it with your partner, you know, if you live with somebody at home, but you otherwise you would probably watch it alone. So it's not a community building activity.
And you're consuming something too, right?
Exactly.
Like you're not. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you can see how, you know, before Americans might have found a lot of meaning in their free time because they were getting together with other people. You know, they were playing tennis or they were, you know, getting together with their kids' friends and, you know, having picnics or whatever. They were going to amusement parks. But today, if we're just sitting at home and watching TV, that's not a meaningful activity, even if we think we're enjoying it at the time. And so I think we've gotten really bad at spending our leisure time. We're not using it well. And I think that's another reason why Americans have come to find work so meaningful, because it's probably like the only aspect of their lives that's difficult, you know, that's challenging, right, that requires you to come together with people and overcome all these obstacles and do something that feels impossible at the time. And that's hard work, you know, it takes a lot of effort, but that's also, there's also something really magical to that. And Americans used to do that in their free time, but they don't anymore.
Oh, that is so interesting. It makes me really think of the creation versus consumption. So like creation, you know, even going for a picnic or playing tennis or like doing those things, like you're not creating something in the sense of making art, but you're using your skills and time and talent to make something out of nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So you're creating your own fun. You're actually making something. And with passive entertainment, like TV or like looking at your phone or video games, you're consuming something.
Yeah.
You're not creating. And work is also a place for creation. Like work, even no matter what you do, work is a place of, you do something that at the end of it, there has been a change from before, right? Like you have done a task.
Yeah.
Unless you're getting paid to watch Netflix.
Sorry. If you're a TV producer,
which I
or
would
something,
apply for it.
So, in talking about this sort of TV watching, passive, consumptive free time that happens at home, that also ties into another big shift that's happened in the last 2 years of remote work, where we're spending that much more time at home looking at a screen. And you wrote an article called "If Work From Home Is Making You Depressed, You're Not Alone." And you talk about this relatable phenomenon where remote workers at first felt like they were blessed with the freedom to spend their days however they wanted. But then at the same time, that freedom became a shackle as all of their boundaries blurred and we lost the separation between work and home. And you said that for you, the boundary blurred so much that you couldn't tell what was work and what was life. Like if you're thinking about work while doing the dishes, is that work or is that life? Or like, what is that? Right. Is that leisure? And so can you talk a little bit about what you've learned that this does to most people? You know, not just the blurring of boundaries, but also this work of constantly having to navigate between what life is and what work is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the pandemic and everyone, or, you know, every office worker suddenly had to work from home, a lot of the concern from especially executives was like, are people actually going to do real work? Are they just going to watch Netflix all day instead? How right. will we know that they're actually working?
Yeah. How will we know if we can't see them? Yeah.
Yeah. But actually the, you know, most of the data shows that the exact opposite happened in the pandemic. If anything, people ended up working more than before. So, you know, companies really benefited from the shift to remote work too, because they were really squeezing out even more hours from their employees than they were before. And I think I started looking into kind of a lot of the research that sociologists have done over the last decade or two. And that's exactly what all the studies have shown, that, you know, when you give workers more autonomy and flexibility around their schedules, when you take away kind of these, like, you know, seemingly arbitrary boundaries, they actually end up working more than before. They end up working harder than before, which is a little paradoxical because you would expect workers to work less if, you know, they're being micromanaged less. And I think that finding on its own is really telling of hustle culture once again, you know, that like we are so, you know, motivated to work all the time that when we're able to work on our own terms, we end up working the most. And, you know, it is a little bit confusing and paradoxical at first, but when you think about any small business owner that you know, any entrepreneur, you know that these people who work for themselves work more than everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's me. So I, yes, absolutely. I was my own worst boss, like
exactly,
by far.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I didn't look into the the research in Europe. So like, I don't know if it's different in Europe, but certainly here in America, when you give people more flexibility and autonomy, they end up working harder. And as I think we've discovered during this pandemic, that does lead to extreme burnout, which is really bad for us and probably bad for our employers in the long run too.
Mm. You said something in one of your articles that I like that got me thinking, because it was about something along the lines of, in Europe, the laws that are in place and also the cultural norms that are in place mean that there is no, that basically we can say that we're only gonna, you know, as this, you know, this office or this unit work such and such hours. But if one person kind of breaks that, right, it basically spills the whole thing. If one person is working overtime and going above and beyond, it kind of raises the bar for what everyone else has to do. And the standard's not really held. But in Europe, that's just not a thing. If you're the person that's staying late to like get ahead, you're the weirdo, right? You're the one that is like breaking the social convention, you know, that we leave and then we go to, you know, aperitivo or whatever. And so I think,
and there are laws that say you can't too. Like you can't. Right.
That's what enforces it. And I thought about this because one of my friends took a job recently. She has a kid and she was very clear before she took this job. I am here 40 hours a week. I am here Monday through Friday. I am here 9 to 5, you know, and that is like, that is it. And then of course, what happens is over a holiday weekend, she's getting emails and other people are working over the weekend and she's on her own. And I was trying to explain this to her after reading your article. Well, it's because they're violating a rule that like isn't enforced. Like it's only enforced by like what they say, but what they don't actually do. It's not enforced by anything above this. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought that was, I know so many circumstances where people have tried to set a boundary, but then they're just the asshole, you know, like they're just the one that like, they're the one that like gets to go pick their kid up from daycare at 5, or they're the one that gets to come in at 9 because they have to drop their kids off at school. Or they're the one that just is actually respecting the fact that they only work, you know, during work hours.
And then they worry that their coworkers resent them.
And they do. Their coworkers
resent them. Yeah, because they do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, during the pandemic, I think we've all read so many stories, so many, you know, self-help articles about, you know, here's how to set your own boundaries, like 7 steps to say no to your boss. None of that actually works if you're the typical employee, because it's really hard to speak up to your manager like that. You know, if your boss comes to you and says, like, can you get this done on Saturday? Like, it's pretty hard to say no, because that person, you know, is the person who determines your salary next year. It's the person who, you know, determines whether you get fired or not. It's the person who determines, you know, whether you get promoted or not. So as a result, you have very kind of little bargaining power when you're just an individual employee and you're up against your employer. I think that's what all the, you know, kind of set your own boundaries advice gets really wrong. It doesn't take into account like the power dynamic between workers and employers. And I think also the really interesting thing about Europe is that there is this hard ceiling. You know, in many countries, the government says you may not work more than, you know, X number of hours, whether that's, you know, 48 hours a week or 40 hours a week. So, you know, companies like face very real repercussions if they're found to make their workers work more than that. And employers take that very seriously. Obviously, in America, we don't have such a ceiling. What we have is the Fair Labor Standards Act that was passed during the Great Depression, which it's kind of more like a suggestion on the work week than, you know, a ceiling, because it sets the standard work week at 40 hours a week. And then if you make people work more than that, then you have to pay time and a half in overtime pay. Mm-hmm. But the really interesting thing is that that pretty much only applies to hourly workers, who are a smaller segment of our workforce today compared to back in the 1930s. Back then, salaried white-collar professionals were a pretty niche breed, but today they are a very big part of our workforce. And so, you know, people in kind of typical office jobs are exempt from that legislation that says you can't make them work more than 40 hours a week. And if you do, then you have to pay them extra. And so, you know, employers have found this incredible loophole to make us work more than 40 hours a week without paying us overtime, without paying us more. And of course, like you were saying earlier, technology like the BlackBerry at first and now our iPhones has made it so much easier for employers to demand that extra time.
Yeah. I have been a boss now for 10 plus years, meaning not like a boss as I'm a freaking boss as a person, but meaning I've had employees, right? Like I've been responsible for people's work lives. And my first few years of running my company, I worked all the time. And I always told my team, like, I don't want you guys to work all the time. I'm working all the time, but I don't want you to. I don't want this to be like an ad agency. I really want you guys to go home. I don't want, nobody works on weekends, blah, 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 blah. But what I didn't understand was that I was totally undermining that message by sending them emails at like 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling them, I was trying really hard to say, like, don't work all the time. I don't want you to. But that my example of working constantly was, you know, created this sort of like psychological mismatch. And they are going to sort of rise to the occasion of my sending emails on a Saturday, even though I tell them not to answer until Monday. And that was a big lesson for me to have to learn about holding my own boundaries at work and around work, not just for myself, but also for the team. And that if I was going to value and say and uphold a culture where we agreed that a company value was you don't work late at night and you don't work on the weekends, then I needed to participate in that or else it just didn't work.
But then it also doesn't work though. I mean, I was the CEO of a company and there was no way in hell that I could work a 40-hour work week and do what I was doing. So it's also, you know, I reported to a board and investors and they needed results. And so I think it's interesting because I think also just like the structures of our economy and especially of like venture capital economy, you know, it's about speed, it's about growth. There are expectations that weigh heavy on leaders of organizations that, you know, it's almost an impossible job. I don't know many CEOs that after they've been doing it for a while don't look, you know, extremely aged. And
Yeah. I think there are some things that companies are doing now that we're all talking about burnout and now that, you know, work-life balance has become such a big topic of conversation. I think companies are taking, at least some companies are taking meaningful, like structural collective steps to try to get their workers to work less. And, you know, an example is, you know, companies that tell their employees, like, please do not send Slack messages after 7 p.m. at night. You know, please do not email your subordinates after 7 p.m. at night. Please don't email on weekends. You know, they say they're giving employees mental health days, which is pretty new. They're shutting down their companies for, you know, entire days, entire weeks to force everybody to stop working. Because if all your coworkers stop working, then you don't really have any work to do either.
Right. You have no emails coming in. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, a very small number of companies are trying the 4-day work week right now, too. So I do think that, you know, the economy that we have right now, the great resignation, this incredibly hot job market where, you know, people are switching jobs at a really frequent pace is forcing companies to try things to tackle burnout in a way that's actually meaningful for the first time. So I think there are some structural steps that companies can take, but at the end of the day, it does come down to the culture of your company, which also comes down to the culture of the country that you're in too, right? It's a lot easier mm-hmm. to take these steps in Europe than it is in America. So yeah, I think it's pretty complicated. And when you think about all these different layers of the problem, it's no wonder that we as individuals have such a hard time setting these boundaries on our own. So as a result, we don't set any, and then we, you know, work ourselves to death.
Right. And we live in a culture where the goal of every company is growth. which is so interesting, right? Like, it's not sustainability.
Yeah.
It's just that the default expectation is just ever increasing, which when you actually do the math, like, how does that even work with resources and, you know, like what the, if it doesn't.
It doesn't. I mean, I think that that's why so many companies fail, because the formula is really impossible.
Yeah. When you think about it in terms of like an entire country, when you think about a country's GDP and economic growth, I think there was like more of an understanding back in the day and like maybe the early 1900s that there was a reason we were trying to grow so much. You know, it was to allow citizens to gain a better standard of living. You know, it was about living the good life. And part of that was, you know, having more leisure time. But I do think there is this way where, you know, economic growth became an end in its own right, the same way that work became an end in its own right too. So I think a lot of smart people today are really asking, like, do we need to grow every year at a certain percentage? Or is it okay not to grow at all? Like, is there a way to grow more sustainably? And that's part of, you know, the movement that's called degrowth in some circles. And it's also very linked to environmental sustainability too, because if you're, you know, constantly trying to grow more and grow aggressively, and that's your number one goal, then there's no way that you're not going to run out of natural resources at the end of that run.
Right.
Well, it just feels like it's all hurtling toward chaos, right? Like that rapid like state of growth, and it feels so untenable. And I think when there's so many things that have happened in the last few years, from like the Great Resignation, but also the Great Resignation just means that the power balance has shifted, right? That they're that workers, or at least office workers, but also I think like workers in general have a bit more bargaining power and a bit more leverage. And then I also think, you know, there was a couple articles in the New York Times this week, and there have been articles that I've read, it feels like at an increasing rate, where like there was this article over the summer that was like, the era of the girl boss is over, like welcome to girl loser. And then there was an article this week about in the New York Times about like anti-ambition and how like the trend of anti-ambition. And there was another article in the New York Times this week just about, you know, why we love drunk, lazy women on TV. And I think that what I have seen just in my scope through my lens is that more and more people just aren't going to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And do you feel that? Do you feel that kind of like vibe in your work? That it's also there's a cultural shift at the base?
That's exactly the story that I'm working on right now. My editor is expecting a first draft from me tomorrow night.
We skanked it.
Thank you for doing this podcast.
I don't even know what skanked.
We've been very, I've been very steeped in this question over the last 2 weeks or so. And yeah, I think there is. I think, you know, I don't really know what to call it. I thought that New York Times piece by Noreen Malone was really good, but I'm not sure I would quite call it anti-ambition, because, you know, I think workers are becoming ambitious about something else. They're lessening their ambition maybe at work, but they're increasing their ambition at home, you know, whether it's like with their kids or with their hobbies or with something else in their life that really matters to them. So they're just kind of shifting their ambition to something else. And I don't know what you really call that. We don't really have the language, like the vocabulary to describe this thing that we all kind of feel is coming after hustle culture. Like, yeah. It's like, what do you call it? I guess like maybe the closest thing might be like coasting culture or something, but that still kind of has this like, you know, pejorative,
yeah, sort of slack,
derogatory,
like slacker, yeah, slacker kind
it's
of
a value judgment, right, that you're not working.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's, it's a deliberate, you know, considered, thoughtful decision that I think a lot of workers are making right now, and usually also behind closed doors, right? Because they don't want their employers to know. You know, part of what this new story that I'm writing about argues is that workers have the power to do it right now because employers are so desperate to keep every worker they have. They rather have somebody who's maybe contributing at 80% than 0%. Because it's going to be really expensive and time consuming to find a replacement in today's economy. So workers are able to get away with a lot less work than they were before, which I think makes it a great time for anybody who wants to try to work a little bit less to try it right now and see how it feels, how much they can really push the boundaries on that. Because I think most people will discover that they can actually get away with a lot more, especially right now, than they think. And so, you know, for my story, I talked to a lot of people who are doing exactly that. Like, they're really trying to push the envelope on how little they can work. And it was really interesting to me talking to these people, because I think a lot of them, you know, kind of went through, felt a lot of like guilt and shame as they tried to do this, you know, asking themselves, am I lazy? Am I a failure at life? Like, you know, can I really withstand this like slight decline in my performance? But I've been, you know, really inspired by people who have been able to, you know, make that transition, because, you know, I love my job. I really do. And I do find meaning and purpose out of it, but I don't want it to be my entire life. And I would love to get to a point where, you know, my own happiness doesn't totally depend on my job performance. I don't think I've gotten there yet, but I think talking to these people for my latest story, I don't know, has it helped? I'm not sure, but I hope it helps in the future.
I think it's so interesting that we don't have a word for ambition when it pertains to things outside of work. Like, I'm still like, my mind is still kind of turning that over, because we should have that word. Like,
yeah,
that it's so important that we have a term like that we can use to describe like that desire to just go after life and to have a full life, in the same way that we do with work. And we don't have that. It is wild.
The closest phrase we have is like work-life balance, which is like
so lame
and so like lame. Boring yeah. and unsexy. Like, I can't put that in a headline.
Yeah, no.
But also work-life balance, I think, like, I've thought about work-life balance for years. And whenever I have considered it, it feels like a really impossible thing, right? It feels like you are somehow trying to come up with this formula that I don't think anybody's ever cracked. I really don't know many people that have achieved something that they would call work-life balance. I mean, maybe I'm an outlier in that, but I've certainly never achieved it.
Yeah. You know, one example I think about, I have a friend who's a physician assistant, and his hours are very defined. It's a 9 to 5. And when he's at the hospital, you know, it's obviously like, it's pretty stressful. Like, the lives of the patients that he sees depends on how well he does his job. But he doesn't have work to take home with him at the end of the day. You know, he has like, you know, he has to study up on, you know, his area of expertise. So he reads some medical journals, and then occasionally there's some like licensure, like certification things that he has to do. But he, more than anybody else in my life, has this like the closest thing, I think, that you could call to balance. And I think it's because he has these really set work hours. He always talks about how he wishes his job is more flexible, but I keep on telling him, be careful for what you wish for, because if it is more flexible, then you'll probably end up working more. And that's actually gonna, you know, eat into your free time more than you think.
Yeah, totally agree. I think we have one last question for you, which ties into that. And it's about the fact that remote work seems to be here to stay. Mm-hmm. And we've been going down this path of items that were supposed to increase our freedom and flexibility. Like, we had the laptop and then cell phones and Blackberries and iPhones. And now we work from home and we have Slack. And so all of these things are supposed to give us freedom, but they end up taking away our freedom, the freedom to enjoy our lives outside of work and to have these boundaries. And so, do you know of a way for us to uphold these boundaries? Like,
can you tell us how to not
seven steps to say no to your boss?
I am about to go get a job at a hospital. No, I am. So, like, Has there been, you know, anything that you've uncovered in your research that in the absence of, you know, we're talking about how it comes down from the top and it comes down from your work culture and that's one way to enforce it, but that if you are tasked with enforcing your own boundaries, with saying, you know what,
autonomy,
I'm going to stop working at six. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to turn this off. I'm going to, is there anything that you have come across that is helpful?
I've heard of, you know, some people who, you know, set really clear hours for themselves and they say they absolutely will not work beyond those hours. Do you guys know the productivity writer, Cal Newport?
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say deep work because that was like where my mind went was what he writes about. I fucking love Cal Newport.
Yeah. And he has this like really like, you know, dorky thing that he recommends of like this like shutdown routine where every day at a certain time when it's time for you to stop working, like you're supposed to say some mantra or something and I don't know, put a towel over your laptop. And it's a little over the top and I've never tried it, but that does seem to work for a lot of people. So maybe, you know, setting strict time boundaries and, you know, even going through that kind of ritual, I think has helped for some people. I think also kind of like communicating with your managers ahead of time, like these are the hours that I work, might help that a little bit. I think that's harder still for like entry level employees, you know, like a 23-year-old mm-hmm. can't go to like their manager and just be like, okay, so like, you know, these are the only hours I'm going to work. But right. I think mm-hmm. when you get to like a certain stage in your career, you probably could. At my stage in my career, I probably could say that to my editor. I don't, but I probably could. And I think that connects to like, you know, what I was saying a little bit earlier, that people probably could get away with working a lot less than they can. But that requires not depending on your job performance for your happiness. Like you have to be okay with your performance slipping a little bit. Like you have to be okay with occasionally doing a mediocre job. I still haven't gotten to that place yet. Like I still, you know, there's like the precious artist in me who still wants everything I do to be as good as possible. But I think as long as I strive for that place of perfection, it's very difficult to live a balanced life. And that's what I'm trying to figure out right now. I haven't found, you know, the silver bullet yet, but I hope I find it in the future. Has anything worked for you guys?
Theoretically, but not
throwing
actually.
Throwing my computer out the window.
Yeah. Well, I think that like the reason I was going to say Cal Newport's work, he has a couple of really good books, but I think his best one is Deep Work, which I think is the one you were citing. And I mean, what I appreciate about him is his prioritization, right? Like we all are adults here, right? And if you are the entry level, I worked with plenty of entry level people back in my day that were fine with doing the bare minimum. I know these people exist. And I think that the trade-off was they weren't getting the biggest raises and they weren't getting the accolades. And so I think that there is like a commit, there has to be a commitment to mediocrity, but I also think in Cal's work, what he talks about that I believe in, especially because I study addiction, is that we have to create, like we have to like cut the noise off. Like I'm only on one social media channel and I don't know for how much longer I'll be on that. I think that things like that, like the technologies that we use that allow, and social media, by the way, is part of my work. So that it's like a Slack in some ways to me. And for me, it's just, what are the, I have to consider trade-offs. And I have to consider like my, what do I value? And I also have to create those boundaries for myself of all the, like, because I have since leaving my last, you know, paying job before I started my company, but also before I started, you know, like basically being a writer and having like any hour could be working hours. I think that the freedom that we talk about from like having all these devices and being able to like be a digital nomad or whatever the fuck they tell us it is, and like using, you know, all these different technologies so that you can go anywhere in the world and you can get your stuff done, has meant that I never feel like I fully can turn off, right? And like I sent a newsletter out today and there's like, you know, comments I need to respond to and emails from it. And for me, what I have to really do is be selective about when I'm using my email, selective about when I'm using the tools of my work, and also be very, very clear when I'm not using them. And my thing is almost just like this tug for it's just a quick thing and why not just always be on? But I think that I appreciate the ideas set forth in Cal's book about really just, you can become that physician assistant, right? Like you can create a structure that is you check in, you do your work, and then you check out. But it does require discipline and structure. And I think that the technologies we have like eroded that discipline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to like asking yourselves, like, why do we do what we do? And that was kind of at the heart of like this like great rethink that we had during this pandemic, right? We asked ourselves, like, why do we work the way that we do? Why do we work so much? Why do we make work so central in our lives? And, you know, for example, Cal Newport's latest book, A World Without Email, you know, asks the question, why do we send so many emails? Is it really necessary? And I think one of like the really exciting things about reporting on the workplace right now is people are asking so many fundamental questions of why we do what we do right now, because, you know, we killed the office. And so, and that was like the, right. the biggest pillar of work, right? And so as a result, everything else came tumbling down. Like everything else is up for grabs too. And so I think part of, you know, why do we do work the way we do is our relationship to work, which is what I covered in my story about hustle culture. But I think it's also about, you know, how we work, like email, the way that Cal Newport argues. And it's also about, you know, in our personal lives, like, you know, why do we engage in social media? Like, why do we spend so much time on social media? What's it for? And I think the more we ask ourselves those questions that are quite fundamental, you know, I think that probably is part of the answer to living a better life too.
Mm-hmm. Just having the awareness to ask the questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I still haven't figured it out.
Thank you so much for being here.
Aki, thank you.
Oh, thank you. This was such a delight. I really love this. I was really excited for this because, you know, I wrote like, my story was like 4,500 words and, you know, I've had the privilege to talk about it on TV and on radio, but usually I have to condense my answers down to, you know, nice little sound bites.
Right.
And it was really great to, it was really great to get to like really expand on the ideas, like say even more than what I actually wrote about in my story. This was really fun.
Well, it's a brilliant piece, and Aki Ito reports for Business Insider. And are you on social? Do you use Twitter?
Yeah, it's at Aki Ito 7.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure, and I really appreciate your work. Emily found it.
Oh yeah,
and sent it to me.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh, are you guys subscribers?
I am a subscriber.
We get a lot of complaints about our paywall.
I know. I'm a subscriber. And I like pasted the whole 4,500 word article into a thing for Holly. And I sent it to my boyfriend that way.
Oh, nice.
Can I, should we hit stop? Should we stop the recording?
Yeah. You've been listening to Quitted, a podcast about quitting, hosted by Holly Whitaker and Emily McDowell.
Our music and sound engineering is by Michael Blumenfeld. And our producer is Kathleen Kizich.
Quitted is made possible by us and by our listeners. To support the show,
join our patron community at patreon.com/quitted.